My name is Jay Plumbeck. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
everybody. If moving that mic disturbed anything, tell me. But when it was up there, I was afraid I was going to hit it in my eye. I started to move around. I appreciate that, Fred. I really do. But, you know, Fred asked me, he said, Jay, what can I say about you? I said, hell, I don't know. You know, and all the things went through your head that you want people to say. And then I realized I told Fred just about what I'm supposed to tell Fred. I told Fred, I said, Fred, just tell him I'm a sober drunk. You know, that I found Alcoholics Anonymous and I found a way that I can stay sober and be happy, joyous, and free. I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if somebody can say that about me, they can't say anything more that would make me feel any better. When I said I'm Jay and I'm an alcoholic, I never thought I'd be able to say that. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I didn't even like being Jay for a long time, you know. And if you look at my arm, you'll see another name drawn on there in ink where I'd stabbed it in when I was locked up one time. I demanded people call me by that name because I didn't want to be me. So I didn't want to be who I was and I didn't know what I was. But as far back as I can remember, before I ever took a drink, there were some things about me that I thought everybody felt and I thought everybody had. And I've later found out that those things were as much a part of my alcoholism as the drinking. And yet those things about me didn't make me an alcoholic. I know today it's real popular to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and never drink before you get here. You know, we see them at my group, you know. But I'm sort of lucky. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, they sort of knew that I had a drinking problem when I got here. All they had to do was look at me. But I didn't plan to be an alcoholic. And they didn't talk to me when I got here about the psychodynamics of the disease alcoholism. And they didn't talk to me about how my body metabolized the liquid. They talked to me about how I felt. They asked me how I felt, and I told them I was scared. They looked at me and they got me to a hospital and got me vitamin B12 and Karo syrup and orange juice because they had felt like I felt. And they talked to me about what was wrong with them, and I knew that what was wrong with them was the same thing that was wrong with me. And I never planned to be that way. You know, when I was a little kid, I know one of the things inside of me was that I knew I didn't belong. I was raised in an upper middle class family in a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio, and as a child I was given every opportunity and every material thing that a child could want within reason. And yet I felt, even in spite of that, I felt that I wasn't loved and that I wasn't a part of that family. I had three sisters. I had one a year older, one a year younger, and one a few years after that. And I saw my parents give these sisters of mine physical and emotional love. I saw them hug them and kiss them and tell them they love them. I saw a kid brother born to that family. When I was 18 years old, my brother Greg was born, and I saw this baby, when he was born, given love from then on up till now. So I'm sure because of what I've seen happen in that family that I was given the same physical love and the same emotional love that my brother and sisters were given. And yet there was something inside of me as far back as I can remember that didn't allow me to feel that. I never felt I was loved. And I think even worse for me is that I can't remember, today I can't recall one single instance of my mother or my father hugging me or kissing me as a child, and yet I'm sure they did. And I think that's a part of this thing that was wrong with me. I had a great capacity for anger as far back as I can remember. I didn't know words like resentment when I was 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 years old, but I hated real good. And nobody taught me how to do that, it was just part of me. And, you know, I was able to hold on to that, and I didn't realize it. I didn't know that until after I'd been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for a period of time. But there was an incident that happened to me when I was very young that was important to me. It's important to me now when I look back on my life. When I took an inventory, you gave me a tool to look back. You said, we look at resentments. And you told me how to do it. You said, I start from today and look backwards. And you said, you write down the people that you hate. And I could do that. I did that as I was taking that inventory. And I was able to work my way back into my childhood. And I remembered an incident or was able to get it on paper that I had never said anything about. Didn't even know it was there. But all the kids, you know, I was taught to believe in Santa Claus as a kid. I don't know about anybody else, but I believed in him. And I was taught to believe in a God as a child. We belonged to a certain religion and went to church not every day. We went once a week, and we were taught that God was love. And so I knew these things as a child, and I believed these things as a child. And Christmas was coming, and it was important for me that Christmas to get a horse. I wanted a horse worse than anything in this world. Now, we lived on a piece of ground which was large by the standards there, but it wasn't big. It wasn't much bigger than this room. You couldn't have a dog there, really, and have it be comfortable, and I wanted a horse. And I began praying for that horse every night. I'd go to bed and I'd say, God bless Mom and Dad and God bless my sisters, and the prayers I was taught. And I'd say, God, don't forget that horse for Christmas. And I saw Santa Claus and told him about it. And hell, I knew when Christmas came I was going to get the horse, because that's what happens when you ask for it. And Christmas came in our house, and we had a tradition. My dad was a news commentator for CBS, and he had the early morning show, and he'd get home about 8:30 in the morning, and when he came in, he'd plug the Christmas tree lights on and put a record on a phonograph, and when we'd hear the Christmas carols begin, us kids would run downstairs, and Christmas would start. And I knew as I went down those stairs that the horse would be under the tree. You figured it out, you know, it wasn't there. But now, I wasn't real dumb. We lived in a real nice house with hardwood floors and oriental rugs, and I thought for a minute and realized, you know, the mess a horse would make in there, it wouldn't be in there. So I said, got to be outside. And I looked outside and it wasn't there, and I got mad. And I didn't realize how mad I got, but that night after everybody went to bed, I carried every gift I'd been given that day, the clothes and the toys and the train set and the cowboy outfit and all the stuff I was given, I carried it upstairs and I put it in front of my parents' bedroom door, and I never touched it again. And I did it, and I remember how I felt when I did it. Today I can recall how I thought when I did it. I did it solely to hurt them for not giving me what I wanted when I wanted it. And that capacity for that kind of retaliatory behavior was to stay with me throughout my life. It's a thing that is able to happen to me today if I'm not working the steps you gave me in the program. If I don't do what you showed me how to do with the steps, I'm able to get that same thing back inside of me, that same capacity for hate and anger and resentment and retaliation, and hurt you because you didn't do for me what I wanted to do. And yet you gave me a program that can eliminate that. Now, if you'd have told me, I was 32 years old when I was doing this thing called an inventory, looking at that, and if you'd have told me that I was going to look back to how I hated my mom and dad, I'd have said, you're crazy. But you didn't do that. And I'd have thought something like that was silly and dumb. But yet I found that was an important part of me. There's something else wrong with me as a child, and that's I was a liar. And there's a different kind of lying. I liked lying. I don't know about anybody else. But lying was the greatest gift I thought that I'd ever been given as a child. Because by lying, I could make myself into whatever I thought you wanted me to be. If you wanted me to be smart, I'd tell you how smart I was. If you wanted me to be a crook, I'd tell you how big a thief I was. If you wanted me to be an athlete, way I lied, I believed the lies that I told. I was in a reformatory. I was about 14 years old and locked up in a reformatory on a long sentence. And I remember getting in a fight with some of the other guys in there because I had told them how I'd won the high school football championship by scoring a winning touchdown. Hell, I'd never been to high school. They knew that. I'd been locked up. But you see, I believed it. And when I believed it, I thought you had to believe it. And when you have a capacity to be able to lie like that, I set myself up for the lie that almost killed me. The lie that somehow, some way, I'd be able to take a drink and I wouldn't get in trouble. Somehow, some way, I could take a drink this time and I'd be able to control it. I wouldn't get in the trouble I got in the last time. But I was lying before I started drinking. I was also a thief. I was a thief about as far back as I can remember, but I never thought I was a thief. I sort of pictured myself as a short, fat Robin Hood. You know, well, really what it was, sort of like this. I might steal something from Fred and I'd give it to Jim. And I never did it to hurt Fred. I never took it away from Fred to hurt him. I gave it to Jim so that Jim would want me around. And Jim would say, Jay's a nice guy. But if you'd have told me that I was trying to buy somebody's love or buy their attention, I'd have said you were crazy. And I never thought of right or wrong when I did that. And yet I knew it was wrong, but I was able to block that thing out about it being wrong because wanting you to want me was more important than the feeling of doing right or wrong. See, I told you I was taught right or wrong as a child. And I was taught about this thing called God as a child. Our book, we were talking last night at the meeting, and a man quoted part from the book where it talks about deep down inside every man, woman, and child is this fundamental idea of God. And I can identify that thing inside of me. I know where it was back when I was a child. It was that little thing that told me inside of me when I got ready to lie to you. It said, don't do it. And I did it anyhow. And if I did it anyhow enough times, eventually I blocked out that thing inside of me that said, don't do it. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, that thing was obscured by all the things my book talks about. Because that little thing inside of me was the fundamental idea of goodness or God, the thing that has later saved my life. But these things were part of me back then. And yet I wasn't an alcoholic then. All I was a kid that didn't get along. I went away to first grade. You know, and in first grade in school, I did real well. The teacher said that I was a gifted child. I don't know what they meant by it, but I imagined what they meant by it. And I listened to these accolades that they gave me about this ability that they said I had and immediately stopped learning. As soon as somebody told me I was real good at something, I knew that nobody could teach me any more about it because I was good about it. So my career in school got in trouble in the second grade. You know, and I really didn't get very far in school. My actual academic career lasted until I was in the eighth grade, and that was the last of any school, formal school, that I saw for many, many years. Because I couldn't learn. Because I thought I knew more than anyone around me. And if you can't find someone that can teach you, you'll never learn anything. So in the second grade, I started getting trouble in school. And in the third grade, I wound up in front of a juvenile referee because I was what they called an incorrigible child. And that's a long word for meaning punk. All I was a loudmouth punk that raised Cain with everybody around me and refused to obey orders or do anything. And this referee, this juvenile referee, said, well, we have a way to help him. We'll send him to an orphanage. Now, that's sort of a mistake in words because orphanages ain't really for orphans up there. They're for kids like me that were just punks. And they sent me off with these other kids that were incorrigible. They didn't get along. And we were going to be taught how to do right from wrong. And I stayed there for about a year and a half. And believe me, I didn't want to be there. And I didn't want to be this kid that didn't get along. I wanted to be like the other kids that I knew. I wanted to get along with my family and the people around me and the teachers and do all the things that we're supposed to do. I wanted to love my parents. I really wanted to feel that love. And I could write it down, but I couldn't send it to them. I wanted them to love me, and yet I felt that they didn't. And I just knew somehow, some way, things were going to change and things were going to be all right. But I didn't know how to make them that way. And I got out of that place, and I did the same things I'd been doing, rob and steal and lie and not get along and fight. And I wound up back in front of another juvenile referee, and I went off to a reformatory. And that was going to be the story of my life for the next 8 or 9 years. I stayed locked up from then until I was 17 and a half years old. I'd get out for a few days or weeks or maybe a month, and I'd get in trouble again and back in front of another juvenile referee or juvenile judge, and back away I'd go. And at 13 years old, a miracle came into my life. I was out on the street for a short period of time, and a friend of mine, I'd call him up, and I asked him, I said, Rocky, let's get a drink. Now, I don't know what made me say that, you know, but I just decided to get a drink. I don't know if it was what I'd learned, where I'd been, or what, but I just decided to get a drink. He thought it was a good idea. In Ohio, you had to be 21 years old. I was 13, looked about 6. You know, I hadn't had my first pimple yet, for God's sakes. And I said, to get to look 21, I'd have to make some changes. So I went to where I usually got my money, my mother's purse, and I robbed it, and went down to a drugstore, and I stole an eyebrow pencil. And I gave myself a beard and a mustache. Now, I would give all the money I could get my hands on this week to be able to see a picture of what I looked like as we headed down on Skid Row. I'm sure that mustache wasn't as dapper as Jim's, you know. But I thought that'd do the trick and I'd look old enough. And I don't know where I learned that I should go down on Skid Row to get a drink. You know, maybe I'd heard it somewhere. And off we went to get something to drink. Now, I'm sure that prior to age 13 that I had alcohol in my system. The reason I say I'm sure of it, because of the environment I grew up in. My mother was a regular drinker. She was not an alcoholic. She's just a regular drinker. She'd have one or two or three drinks before and after dinner just to relax. My father was a regular drinker. He drank morning, noon, and night. Never was he falling down drunk. He was a professional man, but he always drank. And the families that they came from drank. And there were some that drank heavily and some that didn't, but they had get-togethers three or four times a year. Memorial Day, 4th of July, Labor Day, Christmas. And whenever all these uncles and aunts and cousins and nephews and all that crowd got together, there was always plenty of booze to drink, whether it was wine or beer or mixed drinks. And whenever the grown-ups drank, the kids drank. Now, we didn't get as much as they got, but they'd give all of us a little thimbleful or a shot glass full of what they were having. And it was just accepted. And I'm sure that I had alcohol many times in my life before I was 13. And yet, it did do nothing for me or to me. As I look back at it now, maybe if I was talking to one of these counselors or somebody that knows something, they'd tell me that was my social drinking, you know. Because if we think about it, I've observed my wife. My wife is probably the premier social drinker in the world. She, you know, if I ask her, Vaughn, when was the last time you had a drink? She'd say, I don't know. And if I said, what'd you have? She'd say, I don't know. And if I say, how many did you have? She said, I don't know. See, it just didn't do anything for her or to her. Doesn't make any difference. It's probably 25 years since she's had a drink. She don't know it. It don't mean nothing to her. And that was me up till 13. Alcohol did nothing for me or to me. So at 13, I decided to drink. And it was going to be different that day, and I didn't know it. We headed down on the lower end of 25th Street, which is the Skid Row of Cleveland, Ohio. And we went into a series of bars and found one that had served us what we wanted. And we got two bottles of mixed screwdrivers and two bottles of Thunderbird wine. And we left that bar and went out behind some bushes and opened up one of the bottles. And I don't know which one it was we opened up, and I don't know what it tasted like. But I know that shortly after we started to drink, whichever one it was we started to drink, for the first time in my life, everything came together. For the first time in my life, I was no longer afraid that I wasn't enough, or that I wasn't loved, or that I wasn't wanted, or that I wasn't, that I was going to get caught or wouldn't get. All that stuff went away, and I was okay, and it won. And I didn't realize what a fantastic feeling that was. I didn't have any idea how great it was. But as I look back in retrospect, I realize that must have been the most fantastic thing that ever happened to me in my life, because I pursued the recapturing of that feeling at every opportunity from that point until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous 17 years later. And I never got it back quite the way it was that night. God knows I'd get close. You know, I remember times I could be sitting in a bar drinking and I'd feel that thing starting to come over me, that great feeling start to come over me, and then all of a sudden I'd wake up in jail, or I'd wake up in trouble, or I'd wake up puking, and I wouldn't know what happened. I'd say, well, next time it'll be better. And yet it never was. There were some things happened to me that night that were real important. Because I woke up the next morning in a way that I was going to wake up in over and over again until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I woke up in a mess, and it was mine. I woke up with a new fear about me. Now, I didn't know it was a new fear, but I woke up afraid. And you people gave me a tool that I was talking about a little earlier called an inventory. And in that inventory, when I'd worked through those resentments, you told me to look at fears, and you said the way I handle fears is to write them down. And I wrote them down. And I got them all down and went to my sponsor, and we talked about them. And he said, Jay, is that all you're afraid of? And I said, no, it isn't. And he said, what else are you afraid of? And I said, I don't know. But I was afraid and didn't know of what. And John showed me a passage out of our book that talked about impending calamity. And John told me what that meant. See, I didn't know what that meant. He said impending calamity just simply means the feeling that something bad... Something bad just happened. Did I do something wrong with this thing? He said the feeling of impending calamity was the feeling that something bad was going to happen and I couldn't stop it. And when John explained that, I knew what John was talking about, because that was a feeling that was inside of me all the time. But impending calamity, you know, when Bill wrote that book, he used words that, you know, I just really didn't understand. He wrote it sometimes real flowery, and I had to use a dictionary to look stuff up. But John told me about that, and I could trace it back through my life and see where it had been. Now, I don't know that it came the day that I was 13 and took that drink, but I can see where it had grown in my life from that age on through till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, until it finally totally consumed me and I could no longer escape from it. There were periods that I don't remember it being there. And then I would remember it being there stronger than it had been before. You know, and folks that haven't felt it don't know what I'm talking about, and those that have certainly do. But that started that night. And there was a third thing wrong, something that I didn't think was wrong, something that I accepted as normal. And that was the fact that I didn't remember what happened the night before after I started to drink. Now, if one of you would have said to me, Jay, you had a blackout, I'd have said, you're crazy. I didn't have a blackout. I just don't remember. I didn't know that was the same thing. You know, blackouts just weren't in my vocabulary. You know, I've made a study since I've been an Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's a lot of alcoholics that have never had blackouts, and they're as seriously alcoholic as I am. So having blackouts is not a requirement to be here. But on the other hand, I have never met one individual who has had a blackout related to alcohol that was not an alcoholic. So there I had symptoms right at the beginning that classified me as what we would call an alcoholic. No control when I started taking the first drink. That's what our book uses as a definition. It didn't say I had to be a fallen down drunk. It talked to me on page 21. It said, what about the real alcoholic? When you gave me that definition, that described me as accurately at 13 as it did at 30 and a half when I got here. You said, what about the real alcoholic? He or she is that individual who may or may not be a heavy drinker, may or may not be a daily drinker, but at some point in his drinking career begins to lose control once he takes the first drink. And I lost control at 13 years old. You know, that blackout. You know, blackouts, a lot of people say they're afraid of. I was never afraid of them. When I woke up that morning, I accepted not remembering as being a part of that just went with drinking. I just thought it was part of the game. And as time went on, blackouts became more and more frequent in my life. I enjoyed blackouts because when I was in a blackout, I didn't feel as though I had to accept responsibility for my actions. I know that I am responsible for what I did or didn't do when I was in a blackout. I know that today. But during that part of my alcoholism, I didn't accept responsibility if I didn't remember. So blackouts were sort of a cushion for me. And I had these things going on at 13. And I didn't drink daily from that point until I got here. But every chance I got, I took a drink. I maintained sobriety for about 4 years after that first drunk. And it wasn't because I just stopped drinking. It was because they caught me and locked me up on an indefinite sentence. And I went away to this reformatory in New York. And when I was 17 and a half years old, I'd like to tell you that I was rehabilitated and they turned me back on the street, but that wasn't it. I ran away from there and went back down on a skid row. And I did things I'd learned how to do, and I got a wino to sign me into the service as if he was my father and I was his son. Went away to Great Lakes Naval Training Center. I wrote my parents a letter from boot camp, and I told them I was in the Navy and that I was going to make them proud of me. I was going to serve our country, and I was going to be like the, I didn't tell them that I was going to be like the guy in the recruiting poster, but that's how I pictured it. I was going to be like that guy. Hell, he was 6 foot tall, had black hair, and I knew he had a lot of girlfriends. I hadn't even had a date, for God's sakes. You know, well, if I had, I wouldn't tell you about it. You know where I'd been locked up. You figure that one out. But, you know, I wanted to be somebody and be something, and I wanted to have this relationship with them, and I wrote them that letter, and they wrote me back. They told me they were glad I was in the service, and they were proud of me, and they were going to come up and watch me graduate from boot camp. It was the first good thing I'd ever given them that they could look at. You know, I didn't know what happened or what they had found out until I'd been sober in this thing for a while. But right after I ran away, the first thing the law did was go to their house. They wanted me back because I was an escaped criminal. And my parents got a lawyer. They'd borrowed some money because they were on hard times. And they went to a lawyer, and the lawyer went to juvenile courts. And the juvenile courts agreed to let me stay in the service because they were going to have to turn me loose at 18 anyhow. And they said if I was in the service for 4 years, that controlled environment might help to make me a productive citizen. I didn't know that all these people were working for me and trying to help me and trying to make me into something decent and good. I figured everybody was against me and was out to hurt me. And I knew if people would leave me alone, I'd be all right. Didn't know that they all were trying to help me anyhow. My parents came up and watched this graduation from boot camp, and it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't like graduating from college or something, but it was a big deal for them. They rode a bus up there, a Greyhound bus, and they saw this ceremony. They took me into Chicago on a 12-hour pass. We went into a restaurant, and I felt good inside, and I was going to be friends with my parents, and things were going to be different. My dad looked at me, and he said, "Son, I know you're not legally old enough to drink, but if you're old enough to be in the service, in my opinion, you can drink. What would you like?" And, you know, I got that good feeling. Now my dad and I were going to be drinking buddies, and that's something I always wanted to be with him. And I said, "I'll have a beer." And he ordered me a beer, and he ordered my mother a Coca-Cola, and he ordered himself a cup of coffee. And I looked at him, and I said, "What's the matter? Aren't you drinking?" I never knew him not to drink. Coming home from church, he had a drink under the dashboard, you know. He always had a drink. 4 a.m. when he got up, there was one in the refrigerator waiting to go. Now he wasn't drinking. My mother looked at me, you know, she had that funny look in her eyes some of these women get. She said, "No," she said, "your dad doesn't drink anymore. He's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's been sober 3 months. My dad got sober in a place called Rosary Hall in Cleveland, Ohio, and he damn near died coming off his last drunk. He was in straps for 5 days, and I didn't know it then. 3 months sober, his grip on sobriety was very tenuous at best. So you'd have thought I'd have had that feeling we get for that drunk that's just trying to get sober. But I didn't have that feeling. I'll tell you how I felt. I felt the same way I felt when the horse wasn't under the Christmas tree. I was angry and mad. I knew inside of me that the only reason he wasn't drinking is because he didn't want to be my friend. And I looked at my watch and said, "How quick can I get away from these people and meet my friends and do some drinking?" This is the same guy that a minute ago told you he wanted to be a loving son and have a relationship with his family. When you talk to me about that alcohol is but a symptom of my disease, but that my disease is really selfishness and self-centeredness, all I have to do is look back at my life and see where selfishness and self-centeredness controlled every area of my life. All I got to do is look at it. My career, I left them real quick that evening and met some other guys and did my drinking and wound up the same way I'd been the last time I drank. Same mess, same fear, same not remembering what happened the night before after I started to drink. And I had some problems because the Navy wasn't like other places, and I had authorities and controls, and I've never been big on authority and control. I'm not wild about it today, you know. When people say don't, it makes me want to, if you understand, you know. But there I was in the Navy, so my career in the Navy takes very short time to tell. It lasted just short of 6 months. I wound up in a room not much bigger than the room I have here, and there were some other guys in there, and there were thick screens on the inside of the windows, and it was the nut ward of the Naval Hospital in Pensacola, Florida, 17 and a half years old. Called me in front of a board of officers, and they talked to me. They had a piece of paper, and they said, "If you sign this paper, we'll give you an honorable discharge. If you don't, we're going to court-martial you and give you a BCD. I signed the paper real quick and then asked them what it was. And they said it was a guarantee that I'd never attempt to reenlist in any of the armed forces as long as I lived. They said I was a lousy sailor. I didn't belong in the Navy. It didn't bother me that they didn't want me or want me back. I didn't want to be back or want to be there anyhow. And you know, I was glad I'd signed it. And then they talked to me about what was wrong with me. This board that had met with me were all doctors and knew medicine and one thing and another. And they told me that I had what they would term to be acute alcoholism. They said, by acute alcoholism, we mean when you drink, you get in trouble. And I knew they were wrong. See, they were blaming drinking for getting me in trouble. And I knew it wasn't drinking that was doing it. I knew it was situations and people and things that were getting me in trouble. I knew that if people would get off my back, I'd be all right. I knew if people would give me a break, I'd be all right. I knew that alcohol wasn't the cause of it. They went on to say that they observed other people like me, and that if I quit then, I could have a good life ahead of me, but that if I continued to drink, it would not be long, and I'd be chronic. And they said, by chronic, we mean daily. But I knew they were wrong. See, I knew the reason I drank. I'll give you a scenario. Maybe you can identify with it. If I was sitting in a bar all alone, minding my own business, just drinking, nothing going on but me drinking, and a couple hours later I'd look up, there'd be two people sitting in the back over there and they'd be talking about me. Well, I knew they were. Their lips were moving. They had to be talking about me. And I was about as big then as I am now, and I'd try and do something about it and I'd get in trouble. And those kind of situations kept coming. And then I'd get back to the ship, sometimes with no clothes, sometimes with some clothes, and I'd get in trouble for that. And things never seemed to go my way, so I knew once I got out of the Navy, I'd be all right. I got that piece of paper from him, and I left the Navy, left Pensacola, and hitchhiked up to the Midwest again. And I did what any drunk like me would do. They said I was a lousy sailor, so I joined a merchant marine. And I went on merchant ships and went to sea for the next 20-some years. I got on my first ship, and I knew it was an ideal situation for a guy like me. We signed a thing called Foreign Articles. Foreign Articles lasted for a year. They told me that, and they said, once you sign them, you can't get off. You're there, either for a year or until the ship returns to the United States. Now, they said that we can fire you, but we can't get rid of you till you come back. Well, I got on the first ship, and we went over to Japan, and I took a drink, and 2 days later, the captain came and got me, and he carried me back to the ship, and they logged me, and they fired me, but they couldn't get rid of me. 2.5 months later, that ship paid off, and I got paid in $100 bills, and it felt like more money I'd ever seen in this world before. And by then, the guys on the ship had advised me of what happens. They said, we got 300 ships under union agreement, and each one of them's a separate company, and if you get fired from this one, you got 299 left. Normal voyage lasted 4 to 6 months. I did a little math. If it was 4 months and there's 300 companies, that's 1,200 working months divided by 12. Hell, I wasn't going to live long enough to run through all the companies. You know, so it was going to be a perfect job, and I'd have a lot of money. We didn't make a lot of money, but we worked a lot of hours, and they didn't pay you until you got finished. You got 10% of your money while you were there, and the rest of it when you got off. So every time I'd finish a voyage, I'd have that wad of money, and I could go down on a skid row and buy some nice clothes and feel superior to the people I was drinking with and know that I didn't have a problem, and they might. And when I ran out of money, I'd go back on another ship. And that became a pattern. And when I saw the trouble coming on the ships, I said, well, I got to do something about that because I wanted to make something of myself. So I began to institute some control in my drinking. And I didn't know it, but even though I was as seriously alcoholic then as I was at the time I got here, there was a period when I could control when I took the first drink. Once I took the first drink, I have never been able to control how many I'd take. But for a period of time, I could control whether or not I took the first drink, so I just didn't take it for a while. And I began to progress in the merchant marine. I wouldn't drink while I was on the ship. And I got a license in the merchant marine, and then I put that rule aside because everyone knows that officers and gentlemen can drink. So I began to drink on a regular basis. I remember some very good escapades of this officer in a merchant marine. I woke up one time in a country called Ceylon. I was on the ship. They just carried me back, and I was handcuffed hand and foot to the four rails of a hospital bed. And I was coming off of a drunk. And the captain logged me, and I know this deal, know what had happened, because they read it to me in a court later on when I was a witness. What had happened, when I was ashore, I didn't want to come back, and they were trying to bring me back, and they were afraid I'd get in trouble, so four of my shipmates were carrying me back to the ship, and one of them made the mistake of sitting on me to hold me into this little boat they're carrying me back, and I bit him rather severely. I mean, I was pretty something really to be proud of in a merchant marine, you know. And this thing kept getting worse, and I wanted things to change, and I said, well, maybe if I get married, things would get better. Everybody knows that married people with kids get along good. So I was sitting in a bar one day shopping for a wife, and she walked in. Well, that's all I ever did was go to sea and drink. And she walked in, you know, and I knew at first, as soon as she sat next to me, I knew that I was going to care about her. And when I first spoke to her, I knew it was true love. She was smaller than me to begin with, and I've seen very few people smaller than me. And she looked mad and upset, so that made me feel superior to her because I didn't look as mad as she did. And then I offered to buy her a drink, and she said, I don't drink. Those were the magic words. Hell, I couldn't afford another drinker. I bought her a Coca-Cola, and I had another drink, and I hauled all that money out of my pocket and began to smear it around the bar, you know, to impress her. And I started lying to her, and she started listening. And I found out what was wrong with her, why she was mad. She had a little baby a few months old, another one 3 years old, and a husband that was long gone, and it was evident by the tale she told that he wasn't ever coming back. So I began to court her. And after a lengthy courtship, I proposed to her. It was about 20 minutes. Her name's Vaughn, and I'm sure some of you have met her and will meet her, and she says it was 10 minutes, but I'm sure it was longer, because we don't rush into anything that's important. We take our time with it. You would think something starting under those circumstances wouldn't last very long, but this year it'll be 25 years, so it's done all right. But But anyhow, you know, I began to lie to her, and she began to listen, and then all of a sudden she disappeared. You know, a couple weeks later, I couldn't find her, and it took me a while, and I tracked her down, and she had moved from where she was all the way down to Florida to be near her family. And she wanted to get away from me because she was afraid of my behavior. And I went down there, and I told her that I loved her and I needed her, and would she marry me? She told me she wasn't even divorced yet, and she wasn't going to think about marriage, and number one. And number two, she didn't want to be around me when I drank or when I talked the way I did. My mouth was more vulgar than my drinking, and my drinking was horrendous. So I stopped drinking. I was able to stop drinking. And I was in my early 20s, and I quit drinking, and I cleaned up the way I talked, and I promised her all the things she wanted to hear. And inside of me, I wanted to be the things I was telling her. I told her I wanted to be a husband to her, and I wanted to be a daddy to these children. I wanted to raise them. And I meant it when I said it. I didn't know that alcohol was going to rob me of that, but I wanted to do it. And her divorce became final on October 14th, 1966, and we got married on October 15th. And the wedding ceremony wasn't real big. It wasn't in a church like this or with preachers or anything. I'd run a little short on money, so I had to go shopping for a wedding. Now, when you go shopping for a wedding without much money, it's hard to do. And don't ever take one of your, if you're getting married, don't take your wife to be with you. It's sort of embarrassing. She was with me and got uncomfortable as I was bartering. And I finally found a place on Congress Avenue in West Palm Beach, Florida. It was a flower shop, and the woman had a notary public license, and they can marry you down there. And she had a little chapel alongside of it, and for $20, she was going to marry us, and her daughter was going to play the organ with Here Comes the Bride, and my wife would get a corsage. And I got her down to $10. And she sort of hummed Here Comes the Bride, and Vaughn got one rose that was pretty wilted, and, you know, things didn't start off real great, you know. But I remember the vows that we took, you know, and I talk about it sort of laughingly today, but, you know, marriage was serious to me. My family, my mom and dad were married, you know, up until my dad's death. You know, divorce just wasn't real common in our family, and so marriage meant something to me. I thought about the vows that we were taking and all that, and I didn't know that they weren't going to mean anything, that I wasn't going to be able to do anything about them. But they meant something. I remember a little boy, Ricky, her little boy, 4 years old, holding on to my leg as we were getting married, and he's crying. And he asked me to please be his daddy. And I'd never had a daddy. I had a father, but I'd never felt like he was my daddy. And I swore that I was going to be this boy's daddy. And little Kim, you know, just a baby, holding her in my arms, I knew that I was going to be her daddy. I was going to do all the things daddies do with little girls, the brownies and the Girl Scouts and the softball games and running off the boyfriends and, you know, the whole deal. I didn't know that alcohol and alcoholism was going to keep me from it. And we got married, and we went over to her aunt's house, and I wasn't drinking. You know, I'd been to a lot of weddings. I'm sort of a professional wedding goer, you know, as a seaman I was. When I'd run short of money, if I couldn't catch a ship, if I was in New York or in the New York area or over on the West Coast, wherever I was, I'd look in the papers when I was short on money. I'd look for Polish or Italian weddings. And anyone who's been in those areas knows some of you might want to go back drinking or decide to go back drinking, you know, just file this one away. But if you go to one of them big weddings, there's so many people there, nobody knows everybody. And if you put on a nice suit and don't puke on anyone, you can drink all night. They say, who are you with? Say, the friend of the groom's. They just never know. First puke and you're gone, I'll tell you that. But anyhow, we got married and we went over to her aunt's house and they had a little reception for us. And they gave me a glass of punch. I hate punch. I have always hated punch. If it has enough booze in it, I can drink it. But they didn't drink. And I took a sip of that stuff and spit it out. And I grabbed this new wife and we left. Same guy that wanted to be a good husband. Grabbed her and we left that place and headed down to Miami Beach for a 2-day honeymoon. And I stopped at a liquor store. They had liquor stores all over. Just stopped at one and I got a bottle. Don't know what it was or what it tasted like. And I began to drink. And I didn't want to drink alone to celebrate this marriage, and she didn't drink, so I needed someone to drink with, and I picked a guy up alongside the road. He was just a bum. And he sat there, and I sat here, and she sat between us, and we passed the bottle back and forth. And I woke up the next morning the same way I woke up every time I drank. Same mess, same fear. and same not remembering what happened the night before after I started to drink. And there was another problem introduced to this marriage, you know. I didn't tell you, when I got thrown out of the Navy, there was a third thing on that discharge, something I wasn't real proud of. But you see, the Navy doesn't give you big beds like they have over here, this beautiful place we're staying, or I'm staying at. They give you little canvas racks about 2.5 foot wide and 6 foot long, and they stack them up high, and the newest guy gets the highest rack, and I was way up here, and I had four guys underneath me, and they were complaining to the division officer every morning about getting peed on the night before. Now, don't misunderstand me. I wasn't a bedwetter. I had problems. And these problems give you a lot of embarrassment. You know, I just told you I was getting married a number of years later. Stop and think about it. How do you present something like that to a wife-to-be? You talk to them honestly. See, what I did is I set her down before we got married. And I said, honey, I said, you know a lot of things about me. I approached it. You know, you don't have to tell me about honesty. Jim, I know how to deal with it. I did it with her. I said, you know a lot of things about me, but there's one thing that I haven't been able to tell you. I've just been ashamed. And she said, what's that? I said, well, I don't know if you'll understand. She said, well, I will. I said, well, when I was away serving our country in the East, and she looked at me, I said, I came down with a very serious kidney ailment as a result of a tropical disease, and I've been to Hopkins Institute, and they haven't been able to cure it. And it has given me some periods of incontinence. Now, doesn't that sound better than wet in the bed? See, she had never heard of Al-Anon, and she bought into that deal and took swimming lessons prior to marriage. And hell, she swam good, I'll tell you, you know. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous eight years after we got married. And I'm in this deal for about a month in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to meetings every night. And, you know, I'm doing all the things you told me to do. And one day I was sort of whining around the house, you know. I don't know about you. You know, I got to sort of jump this part. But I know about me. I was here, and I'd read that thing in there where they said I was a sick person, and I bought into that. And I was telling her how sick I was one day. I told her, I said, you know, I ain't had a drink in 30-some days, and I've been going to Alcoholics Anonymous every night, and they still won't hire me back on a ship. And she looked at me and said, well, of course not. They told you had to be sober for a while. And she walked away. We had trouble communicating. You know, I went up to her and I said, hey. Now, that was her name by that time in our relationship, hey. I said, hey. I said, I've been sober 30-some days. I said, you know, and the landlord's still bugging me all the time. I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he keeps bugging me. She said, well, you haven't paid the rent. And she walked out. Now, things weren't real good, you know, and I went up to her again. I said, hey, you. I used her last name and sort of jobbed her a little bit. And she spun around real quick, you know, and I said, I've been sober 30-some days and going to Alcoholics Anonymous every night. I said, and I still go to the bathroom all the time. And she looked at me and sort of reared back and said, yeah. She said, but do you realize you've been getting out of bed every night? I hadn't realized it. You see, what was wrong with me then is the same thing can get wrong with me now. You talk to me about selfishness and self-centeredness being the root of my problem. All I thought about then, 30 days sober, was me. Me not working, the landlord bugging me, her not loving me, the kids not liking me. All these, I was thinking about me, never thought about nothing else. And didn't realize what God was doing through me or to me. Hadn't even realized he dried up the bed. I didn't realize he didn't do that for me. He did it for her, probably. Didn't want her to get pneumonia. But I wasn't aware of it. And I wonder today sometimes, how many times do I miss God's gifts to me? How many times do I miss what he's doing to me and through me when I'm thinking about me or things that I want to do or things I should have done or things that should happen to me? You see, the same root of my problem is the same today as it was then. When things ain't going right, it's because of me thinking of me instead of me thinking of you. But anyhow, there I was getting married and things not off to a good start, and woke up that morning on our day after we got married, and she's crying in the bed. And I ain't talking about those little tears that just mess the makeup. I mean those heartbreaking deals that hurt you real bad. Hurt the one listening worse, I guess, than it hurts the one crying. And I asked her what was wrong, and I knew what was wrong. And she told me, she said, I've lived this way before and I don't want to live this way anymore. And I swore to her that it'd never happen again. And I meant that oath that I took that day. And I broke it over and over again for the next 8 years. And things got worse and worse in that house. The only thing that might have kept that marriage was the fact that I was away at sea most of the time. A son was born of that marriage in 1968, and I remember nothing about it. And in 1974, I found myself knocking on a man's back door who lived 1,200 miles away from where we did. We lived in South Florida. I was knocking on his back door, and he answered it. And when he opened the door, the first words out of my mouth were, "I think I have a problem drinking." I'd never mouthed that phrase or said anything about my drinking to anybody before. People had talked to me about my drinking, but I'd never said anything or admitted I had a problem. And this guy just laughed and invited me into his house, carried me back to his study and set me down on a couch and gave me a book, the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Asked me to open it up, and I opened it up, and on the flyleaf there were some words written. It said, "If you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it," and there were just some jots there, and it was signed, "Love, Dad." My dad had bought that book for me a while before, and he just had it waiting for me in his desk. And he'd never said a word to me about Alcoholics Anonymous or about my drinking. See, because my dad maintained continuous sobriety from the day he got out of Rosary Hall until the day he died 10 years ago. And he listened to you people in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was an active member here. And you people had told him. As he came to you and told you about my drinking and where I was going and what I was doing, you people told him, don't say anything to him about it. The word will have to come from somebody else, and if you say something to him, he's going to ignore it like he has all other advice you've ever given him. And I'm so grateful that my father followed your advice, because had he said something to me prior to then, I might not have had any door to knock on at the time I had to go somewhere. He asked me to go to a meeting that night. This is on March the 7th, 1974, and I wouldn't go because I was drunk. And he tried to get me to go drunk. He said, "I'll take any man to his first meeting drunk." But I wouldn't go, and I went out that night. But before I went out, he wrote down two names on a piece of paper, and he asked me to put it in my billfold. He said, "Tomorrow morning," he said, "these two names," he said, "if you wake up, when you wake up, call one of these names before you take a drink, if you'd rather be sober than be drunk." He said, "And then if you want to go to a meeting tomorrow night, I'll take you." Well, I went out that night, and I don't know where I went or what I did other than I drank. And I woke up the next morning the same way I'd been waking up. I don't know how long I'd been asleep, an hour or 2 hours. My pattern by then had been drinking round the clock. And whenever I opened my eyes, there was a drink next to me. And when I opened my eyes that morning on March the 8th, there was a drink next to me, and I wanted it. I wanted it as badly as I ever wanted a drink. I needed it as badly as I'd ever needed a drink. I knew the only way I could feel anything better was to take that drink. And yet inside of me was something different, and that was a desire not to drink that was stronger than that wanting to drink. We see in our meeting place of Alcoholics Anonymous that phrase, "but for the grace of God." Grace comes from a Latin word that means gift. And I believe I had not prayed and asked God to help me that morning, but I believe that other people had prayed for me, and I believe that God's gift to me that morning was that desire not to drink that was stronger than the desire to drink. There was a pure gift, and I believe that it was given to me with a responsibility that day that I was going to have to do all in my power to fan that spark of a desire into an all-consuming flame for sobriety. That first day, I couldn't do much. I wanted to drink badly, and I had those two numbers in my pocket, and I didn't call him, but it was like an insurance policy because he had told me I could call him. I've had numbers in my pocket from that day till this, knowing I could call him, and sometimes I've called him. And I met him that night, and by then I was sick and I was shaking, and my wife had taken me to a hospital, and they gave me some shots. And it wasn't the stuff we get today, you know, the funny names and that. It was vitamin B12 that they gave me in my rear end, and they said I was going to get a series of them that helped with the nerves. And they told her to give me K-Ro syrup and orange juice. They said, "Honey," but we couldn't afford honey and orange juice. We could afford that K-Ro syrup, though it was cheap. And she's pouring that stuff into me, and God, I hated it. I don't eat K-Ro syrup today, about like punch, you know, just don't want any of the either. But anyhow, that's what they were giving me. And I met my dad that night, and by then I was really in pretty bad shape. And he met me and carried me to a meeting. And it was a meeting about like this, only it was a men's meeting, I believe, in Parma, Ohio. We came in the back door, and as we came in, there was a guy standing there. And the guy stuck his hand out, and he grabbed mine. And my father said, "That's Jimmy, and he's your sponsor." My father took off, and I got this guy holding my hand, who I'd never seen before. And Jimmy said, "I am Jimmy, and I'm glad to meet you." And I'll never forget his handshake as long as I live. His handshake was warm, and it was firm, and it was dry. And I knew what my hand felt like. It was cold, and it was wet, and it was scared. And Jimmy gave me the handshake of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said he was glad to meet me. And he began to talk to me about himself. Nobody had ever done that. See, everybody else always talked to me about me. When they blackballed me out of the Merchant Marine in 1973, they didn't just say I was laid off. I was blackballed because I was a chronic alcoholic. When the priest would tell me I was going to hell, when the doctors told me I was dying, they talked to me about my alcoholism. And Jimmy didn't do that. Jimmy was a coal miner from West Virginia that was working in an auto plant in Cleveland, Ohio. He belonged to a religion I had never heard of. He belonged to a set of politics that I didn't believe in. There was nothing in the world that Jimmy and I should have had in common. And yet Jimmy talked to me about what alcohol did to him when he took a drink. And as he talked to me about how he drank and what happened when he drank, I knew that Jimmy was like me. And I've never doubted it from then till now. And then the meeting started, and the guy talked, and there were some funny things said. I don't know what they were. But I remember laughing some, and I remember after the meeting, some of them getting me aside and telling me to keep coming back and to hang in there, and I was doing great. Hell, I hadn't done nothing but show up. But I remember them saying that, and I felt good. And then Jimmy talked to me some more. And Jimmy asked me how I felt. And I don't know if you remember or not, but I do, and I never want to forget how badly I felt that night, how scared I was, and how sick I was, and how afraid I was. And I told Jimmy as honestly as I could how I felt. It wasn't as honestly as I can tell you tonight, but it was the best I could do then, and he laughed. And Jimmy said, "Jay, I'm going to promise you something. If you do three things for me on a daily basis, I guarantee you that you'll never have to feel this way ever again." And I said, "What are they?" He said, "In the morning when you wake up, I want you to say, 'God, help me not take a drink today.' Then if you can, go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And before you go to bed, say, 'Thank you, God, for a sober day.'" I said, "Jimmy, I can do that business about going to the meetings, but I can't do that business about God because I don't believe in God." By that point in my life, the things I'd been taught as a child were no longer a part of me. And I didn't know if God was or wasn't, but I knew I didn't believe. But Jimmy was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and knew our book, and he laughed. And he said, "Hell, you don't have to believe. Just say it." Well, that was easy. Hell, I told you I'm a liar. Say anything. But Jimmy said that. He said, "Just say it. Don't believe it. Just say it." And that made it easy. And you see, that's what our book says. Our book says we don't have to believe. It says if we believe or are even willing to believe, we're on our way. And all Jimmy was trying to do was establish willingness. And I began to say that every morning and every night. I'd say, "God, help me not drink today." Didn't mean it. Didn't believe it. I'd go to a meeting, and I'd say, "Thank you, God, for a sober day." And I stayed up there in Cleveland for about 2.5-3 weeks. And a couple weeks after I was up there, we're heading back from a meeting. And by then, I wasn't as sick as I'd been, and physically as sick. And I remember coming back that night, and I told Jimmy, I said, "Jimmy, I still don't believe in that God business." And he stopped the car, and he talked to me. He said, "Jay, tonight was the first night you've ever been asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. What was it?" And I'd been asked to read the steps, the traditions. I can't remember today. And he said, "Before you read them, what did you say?" And I said, "Well, I'm Jay, and I'm an alcoholic." He said, "What is an alcoholic?" And he talked to me a long time about what an alcoholic was, and I had to explain to him what I thought it was. And after I got about finished, he laughed, and he said, "Hell, I know you are." He said, "But I just wanted to make sure you knew you were." He said, "But have you been doing what I told you to do every morning and every night?" And I said, "Yeah, I have, Jimmy, and I feel phony about it, and I don't believe it, and I just still don't believe in God." And Jimmy said, "Well, Jay, how long has it been since you've had a drink?" And I don't remember today how long it was, but then I knew, you know, to the hour. And I believe I said 10 days or 12 days or whatever long period of time it had been. And then Jimmy asked me a question that changed the direction of my life forever. He said, when was the last time you have been this long without a drink? And I felt an awareness come over me of a power that I call God. It wasn't a burning bush or a sight or a scene. It was just a feeling that came over me that there was a power working in my life that had allowed me not to take a drink for that unbelievably long period of time. I couldn't conceive of a day without a drink, let alone 10 or 12 or whatever it was. And I knew a power had helped me. I'd like to tell you at that point, I grabbed the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and everything has been wonderful, but that isn't the way it is. I was sober about a year and a half and I never stopped doing a lot of things I'd been doing except not drinking. And I was sitting in a meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous, one step ahead of the law, on the verge of a bankruptcy, in marital trouble, everything going bad all around me. And a man took me aside after that meeting, a guy named John, and he said, Jay, I love you, and you're a phony, and you're about to get drunk. And I felt the same acceptance that I'd felt from Jimmy when he said he was glad to meet me. And John carried me to his trailer that night, and we began the journey of Alcoholics Anonymous through our steps. The fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous allowed me that breathing period where I could be willing to do the work necessary in the steps. God allowed me to continue doing the things I was doing until the pain from that got me to the point where I was either going to drink or do the step, work the steps. That night, Jimmy and I worked the first three steps. John and I worked the first three steps, and I say we worked them. John talked to me about them, and I accepted the principles within them. And he sent me home that night with the tablet, and I took that inventory that I told you about. My inventory took me 18 months and one night. My fifth step was the next day, six and seven the next day. And I began to prepare myself for the amends the way you told me to do it. And then I began to make the amends. And I knew the amends were made properly when I got the feeling inside of me that in every situation, everything was okay between me and God and the individual that I was making the amends with. But I had one area that I was having trouble with, and that was my dad. My dad and I had never been close. We went to meetings together after I got first 7 years I was sober. Before he died, we went to meetings together, and I felt closer to him, but I never felt like he really had forgiven me, and never knew if I had forgiven him. I just never knew if things were right between us. And I talked to my sponsor, who by that time was a guy named Brian. I talked to him about this deal, and I'd ask him, you know, what should I do or what shouldn't I do? And my dad got cancer, and it was a long, drawn-out, kind of real painful deal. His last 6 months, he would not allow anyone in the family to see him. And it was, I wanted to see him, and I wanted to help him, and I wanted to be with him, and he wouldn't allow it. And I just knew that I'd never made things right. And I'd talk to Brian, and he'd say, pray about it, and just be a son. Just be a son. And I'd pray about it, and I'd try to be a son, and he wouldn't communicate with me. And then one day, I got a letter. I got a letter on March the 7th. Of that year. He died 4 days later, and I got this letter in the mail, and it was a card, and inside the card some paper fell out with some chicken scratching on it. I couldn't read it, but I saw the thing at the bottom said, love, Dad. And then another letter fell out, and it was from my mom, and she wrote to me what it was all about. She said, your dad knew your seventh AA birthday was coming up, and he wanted to communicate with you. And he took himself off all the pain medication that he'd been on. And she explained what was going on in his life, you know, prior to that, but because I kept talking to her, but she said he took himself off all of it so that he would be in his right mind when he communicated with you. And he tried to write what he had to say, and he couldn't get it down. And my dad was a man of letters. He was a news analyst, and he couldn't get it down, and he'd never accepted his coming death. She said, well, why don't you tell me what you want to say, and I'll write it, and then you copy it. And he said, that's a good idea, and he tried that, and he couldn't get it down, and he looked at her, and he said, I guess I'm going to die. I'm a sick man. And he accepted his coming death right then. My mother said, the words are really important that he had to say to you. She said, so I'm writing them down for you. And said, dear son, happy AA birthday. He said, what a glorious and wondrous day. And how can we ever be grateful enough to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, who has given us a loving God, who's returned a lost son and rediscovered a lost father. That was 10 years ago. And I think about that a lot when I'm going through times in my life today. And I wonder about how little I do for this thing we call Alcoholics Anonymous. When I think about the times that maybe I don't want to go to a meeting, or I don't want to do this, or I don't want to do that, how can we be grateful enough? I happened to go up to Akron one day with a friend of mine, my sponsor. He was going to talk up there at a little meeting, and went up one day and we went all around the beginnings of AA. They took us on a tour. I've been all over the world on ships, and I don't like tours. But went on this tour, and you know, I just looking at the things, King's School and the, you know, where the gatehouse where Bob and Bill met, and you know, Cyberling Estate and all this stuff. And we finally went to the cemetery where Bob's buried, Dr. Bob. And as we got there, I saw the praying hands. They got a bronze plaque inside the cemetery with the praying hands, and old vein things sticking up there. And I got a weird feeling come over me when I saw those. And we went back through the cemetery where the gravestone is for Dr. Bob and his wife Ann. And as you're standing by the gravestone, it's just highway running around the cemetery. And it's, you know, I was looking to see a monument at least as big as this building, you know, that'd say Bob Smith, co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, savior of millions, you know, something that really showed what he was. And there was a stone not near half the size of this podium just said, Bob Smith, born, died. And I thought about Dr. Bob Smith and Bill Wilson. And I thought about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought about my God. The power in my life that has allowed me to live this life of sobriety as best I can. And I thought about my commitment to it or lack thereof. And I made a commitment. And I try to remake that commitment on a regular basis. I realized the gift that God had really given us. He took this thing that we call Alcoholics Anonymous and entrusted it to these guys, and they put it down on paper in a book that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. He gave it to them with a responsibility, not to goof it up and not to water it down and not to change it, not to make it into something else, but leave it just the way it was when he gave it to them. And they in turn gave it to others who gave it to others who gave it to others who gave it to me. Same ones that gave it to you, and the same responsibility, that we not do anything to change it, and to water it down, to weaken it, to make it anything other than what it is, but to leave it Alcoholics Anonymous, so that maybe someday there'll be another drunk like Jay that comes to the door, there'll be a hand sticking out there to say, my name's so-and-so, and I'm glad to meet you, and you'll never have to feel this way again. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Things in my life are fantastic. My wife and I get along normally now, good days and bad days. Three kids get along fantastically. One loves me, one ain't sure. The other one we don't hear from. Got a whole mess of grandkids, seven of them last count. Fantastic. They said they loved me on the phone today. Little boy that was born in 68, he's graduating this year from Appalachian State. I used to say I thought he was majoring in gynecology and skiing. But he's graduating, you know, and he come home to go to a trade show with me this week so he could hand out some resumes. And before he left, he kissed me. Just kissed me flat on the mouth and said, I love you, Dad. Thank you. And I cried like a baby. I'll ask you someday, you think about it. How can we be grateful enough to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? I'm honored to be here, and thank you for having me.